Christy has spent an entire summit on one question. The people who just got rich building AI, what are they going to want hanging on a wall?
Yeah, those fortunes, you know, they were made building the surveillance cameras that recognize people automatically, the AI that generates images from a line of text, the software that turns photographs into 3D objects, machines built to capture everything. And every artist in this issue, they've taken one of those exact machines and pointed it the other way. Like Simon Weckert, for example, who printed an AI-generated pattern onto a coat, and that pattern stops those cameras from recognizing the wearer as a person at all. Same technology, you know, opposite intent. Christy spent the day asking what the new money will buy, and, well, the artist already answered what the tools are for.
This is issue number 84 of the Intersect newsletter, already somewhere else. And we've got a coat that blinds surveillance cameras, a computer virus that grows a garden and locks you out for a day, a chair scanned wrong on purpose that won an award, and, you know, needles tapping the sides of drinking glasses to make the Earth's magnetic field audible. An auction house held a whole summit, and the single question on stage was basically, will these new tech billionaires ever buy a painting?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty wild when you think about it. This was Christie's 2026 Art and Tech Summit, and Shanti Escalante DeMatte reported on it for Art News. It was, you know, kind of framed around what CNBC's Robert Frank called a historic moment in wealth creation, specifically pointing at the IPOs of Anthropic, OpenAI, and SpaceX.
So it was less an art and tech summit and more a forecast of rich people's future shopping. Is that what actually happened?
Essentially, yeah. That's kind of what it felt like. The panel really spent the entire day guessing what all that new money might someday want to, you know, hang on a wall. It was basically treating the whole summit as a sales forecast, trying to work out if these tech billionaires would become the next class of collectors, quietly replacing the boomer collectors Christie's has leaned on for decades.
Right.
And Michael Anders of Iconic Capital, he said, AI is driving a pursuit of experience for art, something you can get your hands on. But then he conceded these same workers are so busy building, they haven't woken up to that, which is kind of funny, you know?
It is. It's like this funny wrinkle they seemed really sure of. If these people ever do collect, they'll want rare, unique estates, not anything digital.
Yeah, exactly. The people building our digital future apparently want their art analog. It's interesting.
It really is. I mean, Jürgen Birkesell, the curator for this issue, he felt that too. Like, he really hoped an art and tech summit would be about more than whether the mega rich will graciously extend their desires to collecting art.
Yeah, he did. He found something deeply elitist about a panel devoted solely to forecasting billionaire taste. And sure, that's the natural terrain of a high-end auction house, but you'd hope, you know, for a wider aperture, a broader view.
And I guess this is where that irony, that really interesting point we talked about comes in, right? Christie's is trying to broker a marriage between the art world and the very people who build the surveillance systems, the AI that generates images, the software that turns photos into 3D objects.
That's it. And meanwhile, the artists have already walked off with those exact tools and pointed them somewhere else entirely. They're growing gardens out of malware, sewing coats that blind cameras, coaxing sound from the Earth's magnetic field, and none of them are waiting for a buyer, you know?
It makes you wonder if the value on that stage might be in the wrong place entirely. Not the money, but the kind of mind of fine art or liberal arts education actually builds.
Well, that's a good question. That's something we'll certainly come back to. Before we get to the coat that started all this, a quick word about where these stories live.
Before we get to the coat that started all this, a quick word about where these stories live. The Intersect is where art and tech, you know, actually meet without the hype. It's about analog fabrication, generative design, sound art, activist work, all of it. And it's curated weekly by the artist technologist Jürgen Birkesell. If a room full of billionaires guessing about art is one way to think about the intersection of art and tech, this newsletter is really the other. It's the artists actually doing the work. You can subscribe at theintersect.art. Okay, the coat. This is the one that got under everybody's skin. Of everything in this issue, the coat is the one I keep thinking about. It just really sticks with me.
Yeah, Simon Weckert's digital camouflage collection, right? It's pretty clever. You know, these garments wrapped in what they call a seamless adversarial texture.
And that, I mean, that's just a fancy way of saying it's a printed pattern sort of generated by AI, but one that's designed to confuse, like, the camera's own AI. Like, it's not trying to look like a bush or something. It's just, like, visual noise, right?
Exactly. And it's important that it's the whole surface. Earlier attempts, you know, they had these little patches you'd stick on, but the moment the fabric, like, folded or you moved, the camouflage fell apart. Weckert covers the whole garment, so the pattern just kind of hides in plain sight as an abstract graphic, but it's doing something far more, you know, pointed underneath.
So, how does it actually do that? Like, how does it blind the cameras?
Well, you know, AI-powered surveillance technology, like the surveillance cameras you see on street corners, and like in China, there's effectively one on every corner just watching everything. Their job kind of runs in two stages, right? First, the camera has to decide, is that shape a person? That's the detection step. And only once it's found a person does it then try to work out who that is. That's the facial recognition part.
Oh, okay. So like the second step is running a face against a database, I guess.
Right. And Weckert, he attacks stage one. He prints this AI-generated pattern across the whole garment, and the camera just, like, never registers a person there at all. Facial recognition never even gets to run because it's never handed a face. You don't beat the recognition, you just make sure it's never asked the question in the first place.
Wait, so it just doesn't see him? Like, the camera actually thinks there's nothing there?
Pretty much. It's designed to make the wearer difficult for AI-based person detectors to recognize, disrupting the system's ability to identify the human figure. It's a deeply subversive protest, you know, made with the very technology that that made this billionaire class rich. Same tools aimed back.
That's a pretty strong flip. And I think Jürgen, you know, he really leans into this idea of what kind of mind actually solves problems like this.
He does. I mean, for decades, we sort of told art students their degree was impractical, right? That law, computer science, finance, these were the serious paths. But meanwhile, automation is doing exactly what those degrees trained people to do, execute well-defined procedures at scale.
Yeah, I mean, what art school actually builds, like, noticing things, reframing, tolerating ambiguity, making meaning from incomplete information, that turns out to be the part that doesn't automate cleanly.
And that's really key here. Weckert wasn't trained as an engineer, and that's precisely why he solved it this way. An engineer asked to defeat facial recognition, they'd reach for cryptography, you know, or regulation or a lawsuit. An artist asks, what if the garment itself is the argument? He got here by thinking sideways, mixing textiles, code, and politics into one object.
So Jürgen, he loves that a textile artist can be subversive and defeat surveillance while commenting on it. It's a satisfying bit of judo, you know?
It really is. But his enthusiasm, you know, it cools right there. Because while this works beautifully as art and as protest, as an actual defense against mass surveillance, it's a workaround for a problem that shouldn't be ours to wear.
Right. I mean, real protection takes political will. It takes, you know, regulation, a genuine fight for privacy. That can't fall to artists alone. And it definitely shouldn't require the rest of us to, like, dress in camouflage just to keep our own faces private.
It's a good question to end on. Should freedom from being tracked really depend on what you put on in the morning?
If the coat took the tech built to spot you and made you lose you, this one takes the code built to spread and copy itself and makes you wait.
Yeah, that's Natural Contacts, this early 2000s malware art project. It's wild because it's a virus that just Well, it locks your machine for 24 hours. And instead of your usual desktop, it grows a garden on your screen, like plants, birds, total digital nature. But you have no access, you know, no productivity.
So, I mean, the code that's built to just propagate, to spread and disrupt everything, instead, it's pointed at something so slow, like a garden?
Exactly. It was by Peter Burr, Mark Fingerhut, Bridget DeFranco, and Matthew D. Gant. And they, like, really flipped the script on disruptive code. The question the write-up chews on is, when does disruptive code stop being an attack and start being an argument? It's meant, as they said, to make the obstruction of the machine's availability enforce a halt to all forms of productivity, which is visually replaced by simulated plants and birds.
There's something actually really tender about that, though, you know, like swapping your locked desktop for a garden. It's not a ransomware demanding Bitcoin. It's like ransomware demanding you go outside and take a walk.
It really is. The coercion is definitely the point, but the softness of what it gives you in return, that makes the critique even sharper, I think. We've built whole economies on the idea that an unavailable machine is a crisis, right? They just flipped that on its head. What if the crisis is the availability?
And Jurgen, you know, he really loves that idea of a computer virus as a protest movement. And like an art form, disabling your computer for a day while a garden grows, forcing you to take a break. He sees that as, you know, both subversive and genuinely radical. But then you do have to wonder, does forced disconnection even mean anything now that we pay subscription fees for apps that do roughly the same thing voluntarily on a timer we set ourselves?
That's a good point. We essentially opted into a mild form of the same coercion, but on our own terms. Speaking of taking a tool built for accuracy and doing the opposite with it, what would it even mean, though, to scan something on purpose wrong? Like, intentionally get it wrong? Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what Yannis Berner did with his project Reverse Rendering, and it actually just won him a Golden Nico Award. So he scans an ordinary school chair, you know, just a regular chair, using something called Gaussian splatting. And that's basically, you know, it's a technique that rebuilds objects from photographs, but it doesn't make solid surfaces. It makes millions of tiny floating points instead.
Oh, okay. So like a cloud of dots, not a solid thing.
Exactly. A cloud of dots. And then he takes that messy scan, errors and all, and like pushes it back into physical space. Normally, you scan a real object and the software hands you back that same object, you know, faithful and clean. But Berner did the opposite. He fed the software only parts of the chair. So the tool here is the software, the kind of thing the tech world built to capture everything perfectly. And the flip is he uses it as a practice of, you know, honoring what it can't see. He lets the program fill the gaps with its own sort of confused guesses.
That's really interesting. So it's like sculpture built from omission, from what the machine doesn't know.
Yeah, precisely. He said that depending on your viewing position, the arm moves. Or maybe there are even two arms in the middle because it isn't clear where it actually is in space. And, you know, he even mentioned scanning his own moving family in Budapest. And the point cloud, it doesn't lie exactly. It just refuses to pretend it knows more than it does, which I think is more honesty than most of this software offers, you know?
That's a good point. I guess it reminds me of, you know, Jurgen's take on this. He compares it to that old tale of the blindfolded people touching different parts of an elephant, right? Like one finds a wall, one a rope, one a snake. None of them are wrong, but none of them are whole either.
Yeah, and that's where you see that kind of mind like a fine art education really builds. You have a 19-year-old, you know, who isn't just narrowing into a track that AI is already circling. He's doing the thing an art education still teaches best, taking a tool that was built for accuracy and asking, like, what do its failures mean?
So I guess when did we decide a perfect scan was, you know, more truthful than one that actually admits what it never saw? So last one, and it's the quietest thing in the whole issue. You have to really, you know, lean in to get this.
Yeah, it's amazing. Imagine just magnetized needles floating on water inside like ordinary drinking glasses. And they twitch. They just sort of nudge when the Earth's magnetic field, you know, the thing a compass needle points along, it nudges them. And then they tap the side of the glass to make a sound you can barely hear.
It's Nello Akamatsu's piece, Chiji Kinkutsu. And what's so interesting is how, you know, he takes the idea of like sensors, which are, I mean, built to measure and record more faster, right? Like that's what they do. And he just inverts it.
Completely. Instead of gathering data, he's really just asking a whole room to go still to make the Earth's magnetic field audible, but only if you really slow down enough to bother to listen.
And I mean, the article about it says it really well. These sounds do not unfold as a dominant sound cloud, but rather as very fragile, spatially distributed resonances. They emerge randomly and are perceptible only through conscious listening. It's an act of profound quiet.
You know, Jürgen Burkessel, our curator, he just got back from a trip to Japan, and he admitted he knew almost nothing about Shinto going in. And he said that it's really not a religion in the usual sense, but more a practice of noticing, of just being present. And that, he said, clicked something into place for him about his, like, long pull toward Zen and mindfulness and even his own photography.
Yeah, he said when he's, you know, deep in a shoot, the work isn't really about the camera itself. It's about paying attention.
It really is. And I think this piece, the one that makes, like, the Earth's magnetic field audible, it's that same act of noticing, just, you know, moved from the eye to the ear. It's not about accumulating information. It's about accumulating presence.
And I think that's where this whole issue really lands, isn't it? While Christie's is out there running summits, wondering what its new billionaire collectors will someday buy, the artists, they've already taken those tools somewhere else. Not to accumulate or to capture, but, well, to make you notice.
Yeah. It makes you wonder, like, what else are we surrounded by that we'd hear if we just stop filling the silence?
Does the market eventually find this work?
And if it does being found by the very class whose tools you co-opted change what the work was doing?
And what does it mean that the people best equipped to navigate what's coming might be the ones we told to go get a real degree?
If the artists in this issue are already somewhere else, the newsletter is how you catch up to them. New issue every week. Subscribe at theintersect.art.